Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Sunday, August the 26th. As we like to do on Sundays, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Lots to talk about tonight. It's been a very hectic here 48 hours. Of course, the passing of John McCain, the passing of Neil Simon, a very important personality in Broadway and in show business. We're also going to look, of course, at the week of President Trump. Some would say he had a bad week, but on the other hand, the approval seems to be holding up. The economy is doing quite well. The GDP numbers are going to be revised. That obviously has to be taken into consideration when we consider that his support is holding up. The Democrats are having a very difficult time with this, the shooting of this young woman or the killing of this young woman in Iowa by an illegal immigrant. They just can't seem to say illegal immigrant. There's just something wrong with them, I think, when it comes to illegal immigration, and I think they may be losing it because I think the public understands illegal immigration and legal immigration, and I think legal immigrants understand that quite well. North Korea, it looks like that has come to a halt for the time being. There's a great story that Bill wrote about on Urgent Agenda. Apparently, there was somebody who was selling a home in California, and they didn't want to sell it to a Trump supporter, so they lost money, and I guess the price of the home dropped or something. We'll let Bill explain it. I thought it was a pretty funny example of Trump derangement syndrome. North Carolina, it looks like they will be arresting the people involved in that vandalism. That's a good sign. Bill had a great story this week about the communist China and influence in the United States. I'd like to hear what Bill has to say about that. Murders in London are going through the roof. It's just crazy. I was reading recently about how people in London were really getting fed up with the mayor because they're saying, "Hey, stop criticizing Trump and do something about the crime wave." So we'll talk to Bill about that. Let me say hello to Bill Katz. Bill, it is absolutely warm. Almost 100 degrees, and I guess summer is still here, Bill. I can report that summer is still in Texas.
Well, it is here, too. I was out just an hour ago going to my favorite supermarket to make sure I had enough ice cream for tonight, and it's warm and humid. It's not hot. It's warm and humid, but it's sticky, and it won't really get into good weather, acceptable weather in New York, probably until late September, early October.
I guess that's why they used to call it the Fall Classic, right? Because it was in the fall, baseball, and the temperatures would be a little nicer. Speaking of baseball, I thought I would pick your brain a little bit and take you back. Maybe you don't remember this directly, but it was on this day in 1939 that the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Cincinnati Reds played a game, and the game was televised. And because of the broadcast, it could be seen 50 miles around New York. I mean, I thought that was pretty incredible, Bill.
People don't realize that we had television in America on an experimental basis in 1939. And the only reason it didn't progress was because of World War II. Once the war began, all those electronic development facilities were directed toward the war effort. But there are actually television films of Frank Sinatra singing on television in 1939 on an experimental station. Now, what is interesting, what many people today don't realize, we turn on a television set, we can get a live signal from anywhere in the world because of satellites. Mm-hmm. And from the late 1960s, I'm sorry, the late 1950s, I think early 1950s actually, a person in New York could get a live signal from California. Not necessarily in color, but in black and white. But in the very early days of television, before that occurred, If you had, for example, a show in New York like the Milton Berle Show, which premiered in 1948, he was the first television star, Uncle Milty. They would show the show called the Texaco Star Theater live on the East Coast in New York. There was no way at that time that you could record a television signal. So what they did was they put a motion picture camera and a sound system in front of an ordinary television set. They photographed it. That became the program for the rest of the country. They would put that film, develop it quickly, put it on an airliner. It was called a hot kinney, a hot kinescope, and it would be flown to California to be shown there. And that was actually what people saw, was a film done on a television set of the program that was done in New York. But most television in those days was actually live for that reason. There was no way to record television efficiently. Later on, we had videotape, and now, of course, you have all kinds of electronic methods. You can record TV right on your own computer or your own iPhone. But it was very rudimentary, but very exciting. I remember seeing my first ball game on television in 1947. I was just a kid. I'm not going to say exactly how old, but somebody had a TV set. It was one of the RCA 3030s, which is a classic television set. It was the television set really that built the industry. 10-inch screen, 10 inches. And I was invited over, and I sat there. It was in Brooklyn, and I watched a New York Yankee game being played live. It was a miracle. People just stared at the screen. They had television parties. They had television parties. People would come on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock to watch Milton Berle because very few people had television sets. And you'd look at the screen, and this was the man entertaining you. Mm-hmm. And that, by the way, is where the term TV dinner originated. Companies, food companies said this is a new market. People who are going to watch television, and they'll probably want something to eat, and they invented the TV dinner.
One more thing about the Dodgers-Reds game is that the broadcast, they put an antenna on top of the Empire State Building, and that was where the signal was sent. And as I mentioned before, you could watch it 50 miles away, which means you could really go outside of New York City if you had a television and watch that that game, Bill.
That's exactly right. But the fact of the matter is very, very few people had television sets. I think it was a few hundred. I mean, it was down to that number. There was live coverage on television of VJ Day demonstrations. That was August 14th, 1945, when the Japanese surrendered in New York. I mean, if you had a TV set, you could watch the demonstrations in Times Square. I've always wondered whether that famous kiss in Times Square was actually captured on television, because they had the camera set up, and that was that. I think the first televised political convention, I believe, was 1948, but I'm not sure of that. But it was, you know, by 1952, and I remember the 1952 conventions, they were televised, and I believe that by that time they may have had the coaxial cable set up all over the country. Again, I'm not sure, but right. I remember the famous incident in early television where the demonstrator, the young lady who demonstrated the refrigerators for Westinghouse, which sponsored Walter Cronkite, tried to open the refrigerator door, and it wouldn't open. And it was caught on live television. Now, everybody thought at the time this was Betty Furness, who was a very well-known actress and television pioneer. It wasn't. She was off that day. It was actually somebody else. But that became a very famous lesson to Americans in the dangers of live television. That things go wrong. And it certainly went wrong for the sponsor that day.
Yeah, that was funny. I didn't know that story. Well, you've posted about a couple of people who passed away. Let's talk a little bit about John McCain. He passed away last night. I voted for John McCain in 2008. Obviously, he would have been a much better president than President Obama. But I can see some sharp differences with President Obama. I don't think he would have pulled out of Iraq the same way. I think he would have conducted a different domestic policy. We would not have Obamacare, different appointments to the Supreme Court. So, you know, for people who say that it doesn't make a difference, it would have made a difference if John McCain had been president during the last 8 years, Bill.
I think it would have made a dramatic difference. First of all, John McCain loved his country. Barack Obama did not, and made it very plain on many occasions. The The press tended to play it down, but he made a number of comments about Americans. Second, John McCain had military experience, so he not only knew the importance of a strong national defense, he also knew what war was about. You know, it's been said many times that the people who are the greatest peacemakers are the people who've seen war and know what it is. I don't think he was a hothead who would have gotten us into a bunch of wars, as people say. Quite the opposite. I think he would have really regarded it as a last resort. But he understood the cost down the line to soldiers of appeasement policies that lead to a bigger war. And he would not have appeased the Russians. I don't think we would see the Russians in the Middle East today. Mm-hmm. I don't think we would see the horror of Syria. Do you know mm-hmm. that more people have been killed in Syria than the United States lost in the Second World War?
I believe it because it's a killing machine. I mean, after a while, people don't even keep track of it, Bill.
Well, that's the point. That's the point. I think McCain would have had an ethical administration. I don't know how good an administrator he would have been. I think he was at times naive about people, and it's possible people would have tried to take advantage of him. I thought it was interesting that in the last day since the announcement was made of his death, we've had all kinds of reactions. Most have been tasteful and gracious. Mm-hmm. President Trump, unfortunately, because of his legacy of having said horrible things about John McCain, has not been invited to McCain's funeral. But I think, as I understand it, Vice President Pence has been invited. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they'll be speaking. But it's sad that the president, because of his own excesses, is not going to be there. But what struck me is the horrible hypocrisy of so many people.
Yes.
Who are suddenly praising John McCain when in their youth they did everything possible to destroy his mission in Vietnam and never acknowledged afterward that it was a noble mission and never acknowledged the fact that because we were forced out by politics that there are no human rights in Vietnam. Nothing. No interest at all. And there are sadly some people on the right who just they're the equivalent of the left-wing ideologists. They see only ideology, and McCain was not perfect in their eyes. Therefore, we must trash him. Now, one of the interesting aspects of that occurred in McCain's home state of Arizona.
Arizona.
Where there will be a Senate primary on Tuesday, a Republican primary, to fill the seat or provide a candidate to fill the seat of the retiring Jeff Flake. And there are two candidates who would be considered, you know, hardline conservatives, and then one establishment conservative, Martha McSally. And one of the quote hardline conservatives, Kelly Ward, has been making the most ridiculous statements in the last few days, accusing the McCain family of making their announcement about his final illness to hurt her in the campaign. And we don't want another senator like John McCain. This is while the man was on his deathbed. Now, apparently, she has faded and that she has no chance of winning the primary. But, my God, you'd think somebody running for the Senate would have some sense. And it's going to be tough to hold on to that seat because Arizona is getting a little wobbly for the Republican Party. But I'm glad this individual doesn't appear to be in line to get the nomination.
Well, I think the best chance to hold on to that seat, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but the best chance to hold on to that seat is that lady Martha McCully. I think she's the best chance to hold on to that seat because she, I think, would be a very strong candidate. She'd be running, against a real left-winger.
Oh, and she'll be running against Kyrsten Sinema, who is a real hardline leftist who lies about it. She's one of those who presents herself as a moderate. All of a sudden. And she is also viciously anti-Israel, viciously so, to the point of hysteria. Now, I am counting on Martha McSally to expose all that and to hold on to the seat. But Senator McCain, look, when people criticize Senator McCain, I like to ask them, where were you when he was in a North Vietnamese prison camp being beaten up every day? He's a man who really walked the walk. He sacrificed for his country. He came from a family. His father was an admiral. His grandfather was an admiral. As was pointed out, both of those men, once World War ended and they came home, both of them died at relatively early ages, as if they didn't have a mission anymore. But the McCain family has done a great deal for this country. Senator McCain was elected for 35 years from Arizona, served, I think, with distinction. At times he enraged us by some of his dissents, but that is what a senator is for. And it was always for love of his country, which I think was genuine.
Right. Well, a couple of things about John McCain. I mean, I disagreed with Senator McCain over Guantanamo. I don't really, I mean, that to me, I never understood his policy on Guantanamo. And then, of course, last summer when he voted the way he did on repealing Obamacare. So he disappointed me very much on those two positions. But overall, you mentioned Israel. Had John McCain been president of the United States, there would have been no confusion about our support for Israel. There was a lot of confusion when President Obama was in the White House, Bill. You know that. You've written about it.
Well, yes. Obama treated Israel with contempt. I think Obama was very much a devotee of the Muslim world. And I think he didn't really give a damn about our alliances. He not only treated Israel with contempt, he treated Great Britain with contempt. He treated the Queen with contempt. He went to France for a D-Day commemoration, which I guess he felt he had to attend, and refused to have lunch with the French president so he could have lunch with his family. I will never forget. I can forgive because I have to forgive, but I can never forget the fact that when Margaret Thatcher died, Margaret Thatcher was Britain's first female prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
And British tradition informs a lot of American tradition. She was also a woman who, it can safely be said, did a great deal to save Britain from itself as it was spinning into just one depression after another. When she died, not only didn't he attend the funeral, which he should have, he didn't even send a high-level delegation. But when Nelson Mandela died, Obama was right there. Now, I don't want to suggest that it had anything to do with race, although it might have, but Nelson Mandela was a great man, but a very flawed man, who believed the United States was responsible for a lot of the harm in the world, and that didn't bother Obama at all. Now, had he sent two equal delegations to those events, that would have been fine. But to go himself and not to acknowledge Margaret Thatcher's death by sending a high-level delegation, just wrong, just wrong.
Yeah.
But the press protected him.
Well, they sure did, and I have to tell you that I'm a little bit surprised by some of the harshness of the criticism. I mean, some people say that I've seen some criticism saying that he was going to take us into Iraq, into Syria. And I think that criticism, you know, I don't know much about what they're saying, but the fact is that had John McCain been president, the situation in Syria and in Libya would not have deteriorated the way it did. It would have been a
That's
different
true.
Syria and a different Libya if we had kept a military force in Iraq. So,
and he understood the importance of that. In addition to which, we wouldn't have Soviet troops or Russian troops, rather,
mm-hmm.
running around the Middle East. And we would probably not have a Sovietized Crimea.
That's right. Well,
I mean, Obama slapped the Russians on the wrist, but Obama was not terribly concerned about Russian expansionism. He was much more concerned about keeping our allies in line.
That's right. Well, I was thinking, you know, I was writing down no Iran nuclear deal, no Paris arm climate change accords, no deal with Cuba or one-sided deal with Cuba. I just think that McCain would have been we would be in a better situation, but it never happened. He never won, and that's the way it goes. But I admire him. I had differences with him, but overall, on balance, I think there was more good than bad about John McCain. Lots of more good than bad about John McCain, Bill.
Oh, far more good. I mean, far more
yeah.
good. Far more good. Look, there's good and bad in everyone. There are even things about Lincoln to criticize, although not
mm-hmm.
too many things. But, I mean, we one of the things that we do in this country sometimes is that we build up people beyond life. We did it with Franklin Roosevelt, who was a great president, who led the country through World War II, who at least gave the country spirit during the Depression. But Roosevelt was, in many cases, a very flawed figure. He was known particularly for his dishonesty in dealing with people. But he did other things in a magnificent way. And he understood what nuclear energy was about. He was the one who responded to the threat of German nuclear development before the Second World War. Other presidents might not have cared. But style is so important in politics. He had great style. And that protected
mm-hmm.
him to a certain degree. His successor, Harry Truman, was one of the few presidents who had the ability to rise above himself. Truman's background was narrow, to put it mildly, and he was himself personally a somewhat bigoted man. But he rose above it when he integrated the armed forces. He rose above it when he recognized Israel against the advice of the whole State Department, which was hysterical on the subject. He rose above it when he endorsed civil rights and would not back down in 1948, one of the great moments in American history. Very few people do that. I mean, and yet we will build up other people at times who don't deserve the buildup. I mean, the lionization of J. William Fulbright during the Vietnam War, this was a man who was an out-and-out racist. When he talked about segregation, he meant it. And yet it was always suppressed because he was temporarily useful to liberals in terms of his opposition to the Vietnam War. And other people we just disparage and knock down and criticize and laugh at later to find out that they had done some great things. And, you know, maybe we'll get it right someday.
Well, I hope so, because I think, you know, these people are usually, as they like to say, a mixed bag. You know, there's a lot to them. There's a lot of things to them. And you have, you know, you can't just go off in one direction or another. You've got to look at the total picture. Before we take a break, I wanted you to tell us about Neil Simon. I'm not as familiar with him as you are, but you wrote a very good post today about his contribution. So please take a few minutes and talk about Neil Simon.
Neil Simon passed away.
He was 91, I believe.
Yes, he passed away. And sadly, the announcement was not made by any member of his family. I don't know if he has a family. Neil Simon was a comedy writer. And as I said on my post today, I have always felt that comedy was the highest and most difficult form of writing. You know, any reasonable writer can make someone cry. It is very hard to make someone laugh. You have to be really talented at it. I tried comedy writing for a while. I did, as you know, write for Bob Newhart. So I've had a little success at it. It is the hardest thing to do, and I've always admired comedy writers. He was a comedy writer. He had plays on Broadway that became famous, the plays that were made into motion pictures.
Mm-hmm.
He began as one of the writers in one of the most legendary groups of writers in theater history and show business history, and they were the writers who wrote for the show, Your Show of Shows, which was one of the first television variety shows, and that was with Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca. And the writers' group on that show was superb. I mean, it was an example of what good comedy writing was about, and many of them, like Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, went on to fame later on, and, of course, Neil Simon and several others. And he stayed throughout his career as a comedy writer. And he never found it necessary to use foul language. He never found it necessary to lecture us on his political views. I don't know what his political views were. He never found it necessary to be politically relevant. He just was a damn good writer. He faded in his later years, common in that business.
Mm-hmm.
But we remember him for giving us a lot of laughter. I think he was one of the last writers to understand that giving people 2 hours of entertainment, of good entertainment, to lighten their lives is a very noble enterprise.
Right.
And I think he took, you know, comedy is a serious business, it's been said, and he took it seriously, and he did it very well. And I don't think there is anyone today who really can match him. If there is someone today, they usually get buried very quickly in the need to be political or dirty.
Right. Yeah. They think they have to be they have to attack Trump or be politically correct.
Yes.
And then I think they kill themselves. I thought it was fascinating in your post, Bill, when I read it today, that these names that I didn't realize were had something to do with Neil Simon, Barefoot in the Park, which I remember was a movie. The Odd Couple, what I remember was a TV show. Sweet Charity, I think, was a movie also. And The Star-Spangled Girl, I don't remember at all.
Sweet Charity was a Broadway show.
Right, but these were what I'm saying is that these were Broadway shows that eventually became movies, and that's
absolutely
how I saw them in movies, and The Odd Couple, of course, on television. And I mean, it's amazing to me. I had no idea that that was all Neil Simon, Bill.
Oh, yes, yes. He was a great originator in the 50s, the 60s, and I think into the 70s. Later on, you know, in his later years, there was not as much success as the nature of comedy changed, and not for the better. He was also a man who could speak about his craft. His brother, Danny Simon, was also a comedy writer and a teacher. His brother taught comedy, and so it was a very funny family. They grew up in Brooklyn. He wrote a play called Brighton Beach Memoirs. A lot of his comedy came from his family upbringing. And I think we don't have that type of comedy writer around anymore.
No, we don't, because as you said, you know, comedy now, they think they have to be political, they think they have to be cute. And somebody like Neil Simon understood that people wanted to go, they wanted to be entertained, you know, they didn't want to be lectured like so much of it is right now. Well, thank you so much for that presentation of Neil Simon. I was quite educated today by your post, because I recognized a lot of the names, but I didn't realize that they were connected to the late Neil Simon. So thank you very much for that post. We're going to take a little break, Bill. When we come back, we'll get into politics quite a bit here with President Trump and everything else going on. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, before we get to Trump and the politics, I thought, you know, you mentioned you tried at comedy writing, and I thought that when you posted this about this home for sale, I thought that was maybe a joke, but it turned out to be true. Somebody was selling a home, and tell us about it. I thought it was hilarious.
Well, this was a home, I believe, in California that somebody put on the market for, I think, $600,000 or so. A little shack in San Francisco. They sell for $200,000 for $600,000.
Yeah.
And put up a notice and made it plain to realtors that no Trump supporter would be allowed to buy the house. Well, there were no takers. And she took the house off the market for a while. Then she put it back on the market, and the asking price was dramatically lower. And so people writing the story, observers were saying, is it because of what she did that, you know, you cut your market out like that?
Right.
I don't recall exactly what words I used to describe it. I'd like to think that she was being punished for the no Trump supporters thing. You know, there actually is no law against that. There is a law against advising people that forbidding people on the basis of race, religion, and the usual list, but there is no provision in the law for discriminating against people because of their political views. I don't think there should be. I think people can have their political views, and other people can say, I don't like you. That's fine. But it's interesting that is not provided for in law.
Right. What is interesting to me is how crazy people have gotten about this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the last thing in the world that it would occur to me is to put an ad in the paper about selling a home or a car and caring about the political belief of the person buying it. I mean, who cares what political belief they have? If you meet my price, I'll sell it to you and you move on. So this Trump derangement syndrome can get a little silly, Bill.
Oh, well, it is Trump derangement syndrome. Actually, there was a piece written this week, and I wish I remembered who wrote it, but I don't offhand, that this goes beyond Trump derangement syndrome and is actually Republican derangement syndrome.
Right. Ben Shapiro.
And I agree with that.
It was Ben Shapiro who wrote that.
And I think that's absolutely correct, because if you think back, there is not much that's been said about Donald Trump that wasn't said about George W. Bush. I mean, he was called illegitimate. He was called stupid. He was called a warmonger. He was called everything. He was even blamed for Hurricane Katrina.
Right.
You know, people get on the air hysterical because he praised his FEMA commissioner. Katrina was a mess, but the real blame really lay with the mayor of New Orleans, who is now in prison, by the way, and by the governor of Louisiana, who has now disappeared. I mean, but the press insisted on blaming Bush, when in fact he did terrific things in Katrina by sending in the Coast Guard early. The death toll in Katrina was a tenth of what had been predicted, but nobody wanted to give him any credit. So
I mean, no, they didn't.
And when Bush left the White House, he was disparaged and laughed at. And then, of course, we had Ronald Reagan, who came into office being called an amiable dunce. You could go through the 1960 campaign against Jimmy Carter and not know that Ronald Reagan had been a two-term governor of our largest state. The press didn't want to deal with that. They didn't want to actually tell you much about the fact that this was actually a very sophisticated man with a political history. You can disagree with his views, of course, obviously, but two-term governor of our largest state, six-term president of the Screen Actors Guild, a union. He knew what unions were. He knew how to negotiate. Just laughed at. And there were these sketches on television promoting him on Saturday Night Live as a moron who had to have other people tell him what to think and what to do, when in fact he was always reading. He was a wonderful writer and a man who could articulate positions very, very well. But he wasn't that great off the cuff, but he was a very, very well-informed and prepared president. But because he was a conservative, he was not presented that way. And
right.
Then when you compare that to the lionization and the worship of George W. Bush, of Barack Obama, I mean, Barack come to save us. He come to save us from all this evil. And even the lionization early in his presidency of Bill Clinton. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
We got two for one. Hillary is there also. This goes back really to the 1950s and the disparagement of Dwight Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower came to office probably as one of the most prepared men ever to be president. He had been the architect, one of the main architects, really, of victory in Europe in World War II. He had negotiated with Stalin, with Churchill, with Roosevelt, with De Gaulle. He was president of Columbia University, where he was laughed at. He was the first commanding general of NATO. And he was running against this guy from Illinois named Adlai Stevenson, who, because he spoke well, was called an intellectual. How can we turn our backs on Adlai? We are madly for Adlai. And of course, Eisenhower won decisively. And what was interesting about that is that it was the same pattern that we saw later. He's stupid. He's a simpleton. He's an army man, Eisenhower was. What does he know? I'll bet he's never been to an opera. And people not realizing this was probably one of the wisest men ever to be president. We later learned from a more recent scholarship after his administration was over and started releasing previously classified information that he was the one who engineered the downfall of Joe McCarthy. He was the one who kept us out of a destructive war in Indochina. He was the one who, when action was needed to enforce a court order on integration in Arkansas, he acted so decisively and quickly and efficiently to get black children into a school in Little Rock. He did so much during his presidency, and he delivered speeches which, while they were not elegant, he was not a great speaker. He was a wonderful writer, but he wasn't a great speaker, and he was disparaged for the way he sometimes garbled words. But if you read the speeches, they're filled with substance. If you read Stevenson's speeches, they're filled with crackerjacks. You know, I mean, basically, they were confections. They sounded good. They were elegant. I once stood 2 feet behind Adlai Stevenson when he made a speech in my hometown. He spoke beautifully. He never said anything. And he never seemed capable of anything. And after his death, it was learned that on the great moral issue of our time, the civil rights movement, he was agnostic at best, didn't particularly care, either did his son, and that there was really nothing anybody could find about him that was all that
right,
great.
Exactly.
Except that he sounded good. And to so many people in the establishment in this country and the chattering classes, as they're called, you have to sound good. If you don't sound good, how could you possibly be intelligent?
Yeah. Well, no, I understand what you're saying, because I think George W. Bush was also treated that way because he sounded like somebody from Texas. I think LBJ had that same problem too. But let me get to the President Trump, because he had a bad week. One would say a bad week. Obviously, some bad news about Cohen, and I guess there's somebody else who's being subpoenaed or immunity or whatever. But when you look at the end of the week, I mean, the NBC poll comes out. He's at 46%, which is better than where he was on Election Day. It seems to me he's not losing his base, at least not so far. And as long as he holds on to the base, you know, he'll survive all of this, Bill.
Well, I hope so. He has promised that he would be on the campaign trail extensively. He's promised something like 40 days of campaigning. He will be criticized for taking time away from the job, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But he's very effective in getting out the vote, and that's mm-hmm. what is needed. If the Republican Party can get out the vote this November, they can, at a minimum, cut their losses, but they might even eliminate those losses. Because I don't think there are too many people in the country enthusiastic about voting for a party that's heading for socialism. And I really don't think they're enthusiastic about voting for a party that lionizes a man like Keith Ellison. I really don't think there is much enthusiasm. There may be enthusiasm within the Democratic Party to get back into power and to get that federal money, but it is not a popular party. It really is not. I think we can hold them to minimum gains. I think that the Republicans can hold the Senate, which is very important, because that's where the judges are confirmed. I don't know if they can hold the House. The Republicans don't have that big a majority in the House. And often, in the first midterm after a presidential election, the president's party often loses big in the House. But if we can hold that down, if we can still control the House by 5-10 votes, that's fine. If we lose the House, I think we're going to have a political bloodbath in the next few years. I think Trump will be impeached. No matter whether there's reason to impeach him or not, won't matter, because the people who run the Democratic Party want him impeached, and that's all that counts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what Trump will do this fall is he will go on the campaign trail and say, "Have you ever seen an economy as strong as this? If you vote the Democrats in, it may all end. Do you really want to take that risk?" And that may be a very powerful argument.
Well, I think so, because the new numbers are projected to be like 4.7 or something like that, which is an amazing GDP number. But an interesting article that I sent you was that some Democrats are now saying that they want to stop talking about Trump. And the idea is that they want to talk about, you know, kitchen table issues and so on. But the problem, and you talked about this with the socialist movement, the problem is that Democrats are not really on the same page when
That's
it comes
right.
to issues. I mean, you've got, you know, this young woman up in the Bronx. Well, she's really on one page. But then you get to the middle of the country. I don't know of too many Democrats who are running on Medicare for All. They may be saying we need to lower health premiums. They may be saying we need to do better here and there. But I think a lot of Democrats in these competitive districts understand that if you say Medicare for All, the next question is going to be, how are you going to pay for it? And if you don't know how to explain that, or if all you do is say we're going to tax the rich, I just don't think that works in where real people live. It works in certain districts, I understand, but not where they need to win seats, Bill.
That's right. Well, we will see. You know, every election we have in this country is, of course, only an election for that office. That's why we say in a presidential election, we actually don't have a presidential election. We have 50 state elections, because
mm-hmm.
the state electors are the ones who actually create the president. And each one of the election campaigns this fall will be different. 535 members of Congress are up. 435 and a third of the Senate are up. And each race will have its own character. I deeply fear that we may lose a few Republican senators, but we may gain some in other states. The House is the one that the Democrats are really looking on to flip. But I have to tell you, I think if they flip it and immediately go and get to try to impeach the president, I think there'll be a terrible backlash.
Well, I think so, because, you know, as I was saying to someone, before you impeach the president, you have to write an article of impeachment.
Yes.
And you have to somehow get on the floor of the House and make an article of impeachment. And that requires something more than just, well, we don't like Trump. You can say articles of impeachment in the campaign. That's one thing. But when you get on the House floor, it gets a lot more complicated. So that's why if they go in that direction, I think they're going to shoot themselves in the foot. I don't know what else to say. Bill, speaking of the Democrats, a few weeks ago, Mark Penn wrote an article warning the Democrats about immigration, that they may not be understanding what is happening with immigration in the country. Now you have this terrible incident of the young woman killed by an illegal immigrant, and right away, instead of saying, you know, we sympathize with the family, that man should have never been in the country, they go off on saying, well, let's not separate families on the border. I don't know what that has to do with the shooting, but that's where they're going. Elizabeth Warren was saying that. I think the Democrats are missing the boat on the illegal immigration bill. I'm not saying that illegal immigrants are bad people. You know, I'm sure most of them are not. But when an illegal immigrant kills a citizen, I would expect elected officials to come down hard on the criminal, not the legal immigrant bill.
Well, unfortunately, the Democratic Party has been captured by a far-left fringe, some of whom admit that they're socialists and may be worse, and others do not. But they are in control of the party. You may have noticed something this week that we haven't talked about that was very important, and that is that the Democratic Party has now abolished or actually reduced the power of superdelegates at its national convention. The superdelegate system was put in for the same reason we have a U.S. Senate. Now, the U.S. Senate is not democratically elected. Every state has two senators regardless of size. It was established as a deliberative body, as a stabilizing body, six-year terms rather than two-year terms, where you were elected to be, in effect, a thoughtful deliberator, not subject to immediate political whims. That was the same reason the Democratic Party established the superdelegate system. The party elders understood there was a lot of instability in the party, a lot of one-issue candidates, and they wanted a system whereby the party elders, the experienced people, the superdelegates, the ones who held political office, could come in and act as a stabilizing force. It was a wise move, and now they want to eliminate it because the hard left base of the party wants total power. And if you eliminate the power of the superdelegates, they could nominate a real nut in 2020, or they could nominate somebody who doesn't come off as a nut, but they could have a platform that comes right out of, you know, old Moscow or something and not care about it. And that is a real danger. It has not been discussed to any great degree in the political press because they're not interested, or maybe they don't want to emphasize it. But this is a very, very serious moment when they eliminate the one stabilizing factor in their party's operation. The Democratic Party is a mess. It's a disgrace to the country. I don't even think of it as a political party anymore. It is today mostly a business. It's the election business. Keep the power. And I cannot imagine this country going in that direction. But, we don't know what. First of all, if there'll be a 2020, we don't know if they'll what politics will bring. The president could be out of office by then. I think there is a chance he could resign under pressure. Biology could take its tragic course, as we saw with John McCain. He's not a young man, we could have Mike Pence as our candidate, who, if he is our candidate, will be a fine candidate and would be a fine president. But if you think you've seen smear campaigns up to now, wait till they go after Mike Pence's Christianity. I mean, it's going to be brutal, absolutely brutal. And you could have on the Democratic side someone who's a charmer, who runs as a moderate, as a thoughtful person, could even be somebody with some military experience, and then comes in and has to do the bidding of the party. Now, I should point out that you made the point earlier, and it was a very good point that you made. The Democratic Party is divided. There are still plenty of thoughtful Democrats in the Democratic Party, but they are being overwhelmed by the hard left. And, I mean, you know, even if you take somebody like Kamala Harris of California, who is certainly not my favorite person, she's, you know, they like her because she's, let's see, let's go down the whole list. She's female, she's Asian, she's African-American, and after all, I mean, she's a threefer. I'd like someone to be a fourfer. I'd like them to add, is qualified to be president, you know, but that we don't talk about anymore. But I think that at bay, she's a reasonably thoughtful person. But there are some others who really are whack jobs. I mean, we have a senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand. I don't think she has ever taken a political position that has lasted more than 8 hours. I mean, you know, you have to check Kirsten at the beginning of the day and then Kirsten at the end of the day to find out what she believes. And this is the term senator from New York used to be almost a revered term in American politics because New York had produced so many great members of the Senate. It was the Empire State. When I was growing up, it was the largest state in terms of population. Mm-hmm. It's now, I think, fourth. Senators like Herbert Lehman, on both parties, Herbert Lehman and Jacob Javits and Robert Wagner, who was responsible for so many of the labor reform acts, Irving Ives, people who really distinguished themselves in the Senate, Kenneth Keating, I always liked, who had been a judge. Now you say senator from New York, and you have to think of either Chuck Schumer, who is completely qualified, and Kirsten Gillibrand. Kirsten Gillibrand became a senator when Hillary Clinton resigned from the Senate to become Secretary of State. And the governor at the time wanted to block the entry into politics of another member of the Kennedy family. It was Caroline Kennedy, who indicated she might like the seat. And then she started giving interviews, and Caroline Kennedy occasionally could complete an English sentence, but not usually. And we knew it was immediately realized she was a disaster. And he turned to Kirsten Gillibrand, who was an upstate congresswoman and considered a conservative Democrat. Well, it didn't take Kirsten Gillibrand long to realize where the power was in the New York Democratic Party, and she did a 180 on so many issues, you cannot believe it.
Oh, I bet. I bet. She's really not a very impressive person, frankly, when you listen to her talk. I mean, she seems to be right now bent on being to the left of everybody, so whatever position somebody takes, she takes one further to the left, and I don't know where it's all going to end up, but it doesn't make the senator look very bright. Look, let's look at a couple of other issues here that I wanted to get to, Bill. You wrote a note, the Post this week, about communist China influence in the United States and also about murders in London. I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about those two before the time runs out here. Communist influence in the United States. What was that about?
Well, it turns out that according to some sources that I think are reliable, that the communist Chinese are infiltrating into American think tanks, study institutions, financing them either directly or indirectly through intermediaries, and getting their influence felt. We know that they are trying this in the United States. They're also trying it in Europe. They are, without question, and by the way, they are also influencing American universities, which is dangerous. It was brought out that Johns Hopkins University, one of our most distinguished, has been taking money from a Chinese communist source. We've had this before. We had it in the 1930s with certain influences from Germany. We had it more recently with certain influences from the Arab world. There are Saudi Arabia literally controls Middle East studies departments at some American universities. It's a bad thing. But now the communist Chinese are getting involved. And whether we should allow it or not is one discussion, but the fact that it's being done is an entirely separate discussion, and it should be a very active discussion. I don't think we're going to see this story on CNN. I really don't. They'll figure out a way not to do it.
Blame it on Trump. Now, the murders in London story, this is something that has been building for quite a few months, and I know there have been several stories of residents of London saying, hey, you know, this mayor is doing a lousy job. Stop talking about Trump and do something about crime.
That's exactly, well, the mayor, Sadiq Khan, who floated a balloon over London, he's the mayor of London,
right.
An anti-Trump balloon when the president was visiting. Now apparently a group of his detractors have gotten together and put up their own balloon. And it would be nice if occasionally London had a good mayor. You know, the country itself is in very serious trouble, for a number of reasons. The Conservative Party, led by Theresa May, whom I like very much, but she is not a great leader, and the party is in disarray. The Labor Party, and this is something that is literally not reported in the United States, is being led by a man who is openly anti-Semitic, who has very close relationships with terrorist groups, and they will not get rid of him. I mean, there have been petitions to depose him and bring in another Labor Party leader, but the base of the Labor Party is as reckless as the base of the Democratic Party in the United States. They think he's just wonderful because he's against capitalism. He's also very much, of course, against the United States, which would be typical of a Labor leader like that, and he might be the next prime minister. And this is dangerous stuff. So, and you see a city like London, which used to be known around the world for its safety, protected by a Scotland Yard, is deteriorating. The murder rate in London is higher than the murder rate in most American cities. And
that's right. And they're not just murder rates, Bill. It's not just murder. It's really brutal murders. I mean, you know what I mean with knives. I mean, it's not just people with a gun. I mean, it's people with knives and running over people. I mean, it's pretty bad.
They have gun control in England, and they're very proud of their gun control. And some very bad people figured out you could also kill somebody with a knife.
And with a truck.
And a lot of knife murders in England. Which reminded me, by the way, of a story I would just like to bring up. Occasionally you find a comment so in the news that's so stupid that you just have to talk about it. There was a professor at a university who said that he would no longer take individual meetings with students because his state allows campus carry, which means students, when properly licensed, can carry a gun on campus. And he said, I no longer feel safe. So because of we allow campus carry, so I will not meet with individual students except under certain circumstances and in certain safe spaces where we're surrounded by other people. Now, what makes that so unbelievably stupid is, does this professor really believe that if somebody wants to kill him, they need a campus carry pass to do it?
Right. Well, that's not the way it worked out at Virginia Tech. You know, at Virginia Tech, you know, the guy who was shooting didn't have a license or whatever.
No, of course not. I mean, the idea that he thinks that campus carry makes the campus more unsafe for him, it probably makes it much more safe.
That's right.
But if somebody wants to kill him and say, oh, I can't kill the professor today, I don't have a campus carry pass. I mean, it's just that kind of elementary thinking.
Right. Well, Bill, we're just about out of time. I wanted to take a quick look at next week. The funeral for John McCain will be a big story. Developments with President Trump. Anything else that you'll be keeping an eye on? We didn't have a chance to talk about North Korea, but anything else that you'll be keeping an eye on?
I will be keeping an eye on my alarm clock to make sure I stay awake because the last week in August is traditionally the slowest news week of the year. I mean, you have to force somebody to make news. You know, people go home and they're getting ready for the week after, which will be one of the most important news weeks in the year because it will be the formal beginning of the congressional campaigns. And boy, we are in for it this fall. You're going to see a brutal campaign. And we are also in for it in the sense that I'm sure Mr. Mueller has some surprises for us to try to do as much damage to Mr. Trump and his party before the election. But this coming week, I think the McCain funeral might be the main event. I think if the vice president speaks, I would be very much interested in what he has to say. There may be some other things around the world. The Middle East is boiling very much again. And I think that we'll see the end of the summer polling season. Very hard to poll during the summer, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
As pollsters will tell you, because people go away, they're out of their regular phones. But we will see what the last summer polls say. And we will take stock, because one of the things... Oh, yes. Oh, and the Arizona primaries on Tuesday.
Yes, on Tuesday, right.
But we'll take stock, because in recent years, the political thinking in America has shifted to a belief that what does occur in the summer politically is important. At one time, they thought, you just take the summer off. But now they realize they have to work during the summer. They have to prepare their get-out-the-vote campaigns. They have to prepare their candidates for debate. So let's take stock of that in another week.
All right. Very good, Bill. We'll have a wonderful last week of August. And I guess
I
the next time we chat, it'll be the first Sunday in September. So
I think so.
We'll...
yeah, I think it will be.
I think it will be. So we'll go from August to September in 1 week.
We will. We will. And we should
thank
have
you
week
so much, as always, for your time, Bill. And have a wonderful
absolutely
evening.
Absolutely. Same to you.
We'll talk to you the next time. Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Always enjoy chatting with him, Bill, on Sundays, especially today. I mean, I've got a sheet of paper here, a yellow pad here, of almost 15 or 20 points that I wanted to make with Bill. It's just amazing what a crazy world we're living in. Well, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful evening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.